Welcome to the Disney Parks Podcast with your hosts, Tony Castelnova from DisneyByTheNumbers.com and Krista Joy from DisneyWays.com. Keep your hands, arms, feet, and legs inside the podcast at all times and get ready for the Disney Parks Podcast.
Hi, this is Mike Purcell. Welcome to a voyage of discovery and awareness of the richness, diversity, and often surprising nature of living with the land. Our journey begins as dramatic and sudden changes are sweeping over the land. The approaching storm may seem violent and destructive to us, but it's actually just Tony and Krista. You're listening to the Disney Parks Podcast.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for the intro.
Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America. All the ships at sea, let's go to press. I am Walter Winchell. Do you know who Walter Winchell is?
No, we don't. Tell us who that is.
You better go on the internet and find out.
Yeah, there you go. All right. So Tony, you can leave that in the beginning and then I'll introduce him and then we'll move forward. Okay.
All right.
Okay. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Disney Parks Podcast. Today, we have a true Disney legend on the line for you. Walt Disney himself was so impressed with this man's knowledge and skill that he invited him to join WED Enterprises, which, of course, today is known as Walt Disney Imagineering. In his Disney career of nearly 40 years, he went on to design one-of-a-kind vehicles, versions of which are still now used in every Disney park around the world. So, Bob Gurr, thank you so much for coming on the show. Welcome.
Well, I'm delighted to join your program.
Hey, thanks for coming, Bob. I guess tell everybody how you got started at WED Enterprises back in the day.
Well, I can give you the long story or the short story.
Whichever story you would like to tell us.
Well,
either way.
Let's go for the short story. Walt was looking for a lot of people to design Disneyland, and of course, there's no college class called Disneyland 101 that trains people how to design Disneyland. So obviously, Walt was gathering up people who had never done anything like this, even though they might have worked in the movies or other kind of industry. And of course, I was trained as a car stylist at Art Center School, went to Ford, thought Detroit was a terrible place, returned back here, had my own industrial design company, and through a quick happenstance at Art Center School, Walt had somebody down there looking to see if they could find a car designer, and my name came up, and they called me the next day, and I went out, and that was that.
Wow. That's very cool. What was the first WED project that you worked on, Bob?
Oh, I was asked to come out and design the body for an Utopia car. The studio had a small car that was like a little prototype chassis, no body on it, just a little four wheels and a motor. And a local guy had built this little car for Walt. And obviously the guy wasn't able to proceed with a body, so that's why Walt needed a body designer, and I was a body designer. So I went out to the studio, and they showed me this little chassis and said, we need a body. And I said, well, I certainly know exactly what to do for that. And started right in.
Wow. You know, I heard that Walt picked people to do things sometimes that was maybe a little bit outside of their skill set, but he knew that they could do it or that would challenge them and you know, would take that person maybe to the next level or add more skills to, you know, what they could do today or would do in the future. Are any of those kind of things true, or Walt ever ask you to do something that you said, hey, I can't do that, Walt, that's not my skill set kind of thing?
Well, that's absolutely true, because obviously everybody that Walt asked to come in to design Disneyland had never designed a Disneyland, because so they were both completely inexperienced. But they had skills of whatever trade they were used to, and Walt figured, well, they could probably do what he needed to be done. He had an extremely good sixth sense of, you know, when meeting people, or knowing a little bit about them, he kind of figured out what they might be able to do. He was never interested in what you'd ever done before. He didn't want to see a portfolio. He didn't care who you ever worked for before. He saw the potential that you had to help him with his projects. That was a universal trait that Walt had all the years. Everybody that ever worked there, they'll tell you exactly the same thing. He wasn't interested in what you'd done, only interested in what you're going to do.
Yeah, I believe that. And he truly could recognize talent that inside of people sometimes before they even recognized it, right?
All right. No, that's extremely correct, because a lot of times the person will be they have their own instinct. They have an inherent and intrinsic characteristic that even they don't recognize. See, the problem is a lot of people who are the genius type person, they don't realize they're a genius, but somebody like Walt does. So that's why Walt could look at somebody and says, well, say, Bobby, I think I want you to design this thing. And then he'd tell you what you wanted to design, and he'd obviously never done it. But you could see multiple possibilities of how it could be done immediately right off the top of your head in exactly the same way he looked at you and said, well, say, Bobby, I want you to do this, because he could sense what a person might be able to do. It was a very interesting characteristics between Walt and the people that he asked to come work for him. And of course, my own opinion, I think a lot of them were geniuses at heart in the specific trade or art that they were in.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'd agree. Because, I think a lot of the people that worked for Walt back pre-1955 and even in the 1955 era is, those people built things that have never been seen or done or conquered today. I mean, the Disney Enterprise today is still some of the best theme parks in the world.
Well, you go back even further here. Go back to, say, 1931, 1932. Cartoons have a certain level of technology, but in Walt's mind, he saw that he wanted to do Snow White, which is a color, full-length animated movie, which, came out quite a few number of years later. But he saw early on what he wanted to do, and he figured out a way it could be done. And he got people that had never done anything like that and got them all figured out, taught themselves all of the technologies, the advanced tools, every detail about understanding animals, understanding motion, blending all that together. So that modus operandi that Walt had in the early 30s is the same modus operandi that he applied in starting in 1953 into the design of Disneyland. And of course, by late 54, he was seriously gathering up a lot of people. And then, of course, by early 55, that was a big team of people just going as fast as they could go.
Yeah.
Just amazing. Unbelievable. Yeah, it's really, I think, part of being a good leader is surrounding yourself with people that are, super talented and able to carry out your vision. Sometimes when you're not even really sure how they're going to carry it out, you just know they're going to, right?
yeah, that's completely correct. Walt was very open when people would ask him about, well, what kind of people do you get here? And he says, well, I always like to find the people that are a lot smarter than I am to do what they're going to do. And then I ask them to start getting going on it. So it's a very curious thing that Walt wasn't the kind of leader that said, I'm going to gather a bunch of people and I'm going to order them to do stuff. He was the kind of guy that said, I want people smarter than me, and I'll get them excited about doing it and never give orders.
Yes, and that says so much about you and what an awesome guy you are. So we're just super excited to talk to you today. I got a quick question. Now, why do you think that we don't see more people movers out there in the real world? Why is it just an attraction at Disney World?
Well, the whole area of what we would call people movers within the Disney company, which might be called personal rapid transit, or any kind of elevated transit or even subway transit, vehicles smaller than, say, a full-size, you know, urban car or a railroad car. There's a ton of these systems all around the world. You could probably call them people movers, you know, it's kind of a lump name. When you say, well, why don't we see more of them? There's a ton of them. They're all over the world.
Yeah. I think the people mover, you know, is a favorite attraction. It probably was a favorite attraction at Disneyland. It still is in Disney World. And, you know, I often talk to, you know, other Disney fans and, like, you know, how come we don't have these, like, running around the city to, you know, take us to the mall?
Well, I'll have to point out that the people you've been talking to have not done any of their research. If they would do some research and look at all the cities in the world, there are so many systems that have a people mover-like system using a little bit smaller cars. They're all automated. Nobody's driving them. And they have various routes that they take to service people, say, like in airports, shopping mall areas, certain high-density parts of cities. They're basically everywhere.
Wow.
Wow. Yeah, what you need to do is the people that tell you how come there aren't more people movers, go back to them and say, please go on the internet and search for this type of transit, and you'll find tons of them.
Yeah.
Even a simple example is Orlando Airport. You
right.
have the central terminal, and you have the satellite terminals. What
yeah.
do you think transports people back and forth, even though it's just a shuttle?
That's very
true. That's a people mover category machine. You ever been to Dallas Fort Worth Airport?
Yes.
Great big terminal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's all people mover. You ever gone to the Houston Airport?
Mm-hmm.
There's
yep.
a linear people mover down on the bottom, and Disney built that a long time ago.
Wow. Wow. I was looking at early pictures of the Viewliner that was at Disneyland, and I know that ran on a railroad track, but that design almost looks very similar to, like, the first monorail design. Were those two things similar?
Well, sure. There was the Viewliner came before the monorail. It was intended to be there for just 2 years
mm-hmm.
as a temporary little ride because railroads are very cheap to build. You know, it's just steel rail and ties and ballast and a bunch of spikes and a few people sticking it together. At least that's in Walt's view, you know, because he understood railroads. So the idea was, well, we'll just put a little railroad here for a couple of years and Bobby will build a train that's going on the railroad tracks. So that was the invitation to say, well, Bobby, why don't you go do a little tiny streamlined train here, and we'll build it. We'll just run it a couple of years and take it out when we do the 1959 project.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, what's your take? Now, besides the fact that you're no longer working for the company, you're retired, why do you think the flying saucers, the Luigi tire things, are having so much trouble over at Disney's California Adventure right now?
Well, I was invited to ride the Luigi tire test track in Glendale a number of years ago, and I was very polite about it when they invited me to ride it, and I saw how the system was going to work. There was a certain rationale why they wanted to do it that way, but they somebody decided to use a great big heavy car to carry more people, to put, you know, put two adults in it. And at that moment, I could see, well, this is a fatal attraction. It will never work. But since I was invited to go there, and if I say it's not going to work, then the old girl's getting so old, he's just a bunch of sour grapes. Well, the vehicle for the original Flying Saucer was very, very lightweight and deliberately carried one person, because that would be a very efficient way to do it, because you don't have a high-density vehicle. It gets into inertia problems and all that. So when the Luigi's opened up, I can understand they'd like to do a flying saucer-like thing, and then, of course, they want to theme it for tires because, you know, it's Cars Land. But unfortunately, you can have today, in any organization, you can have project leaders, engineers, project managers, coordinators, designers, draftspeople, and fabricators, all of which follow an idea developed in a committee without any inspirational leadership. It's a common thing. This is why somebody will say, well, gee, in the old days, stuff worked. How come in the current day, nothing works? Well, there's a difference in the way people work. Walt was very lucky. He had inspirational people who could take charge and understand something. And if it wasn't going to work, they'd speak up and says, no, that's not going to work. And they'd tell you why it's not going to work. And today we'll have a group of people that will form a committee and have an organization and an organizational chart and a budget and a schedule and all that. And they all work doing their little bits and pieces of work all together, but there is no dynamic leader in charge.
There you have it. Yeah. Too much bureaucracy nowadays.
Well, yes, this is exactly the way most large mature governments work. Most large mature companies, this is the way they work. And some companies do really dramatically good stuff at taking a very long time, great expense. But they gradually get there. But the danger is that unless you have inspired leadership who really looks at, should something work or not work, you don't have anybody standing there saying, hey, just a minute, look at all these things. It'll work if, but if the work if, like in the case of the Luigi things, well, look how much weight you've got in a machine, because once you get that machine up to a certain size, then the engineering departments will say, oh, well, we have to design it to engineering standards and specifications, and we have to have low stress levels on and on and on and on and on. And then the safety people and the operations people say, well, we have to have this, and then we have to have that. And pretty soon you have this complicated specification, which the designers are now trying to blend all that together. But there isn't anybody standing there and says, hey, fellas, heavy weight, giant inertia, the thing will take forever to accelerate. And at the same time, you're going to put all these people in it. And the more people in it, you get two great big people, things just sits there, and the person is frustrated because it won't do anything.
Yeah.
You put two little kids in it, and they try to tip and lean it, and they can't get it to do anything.
Yeah.
But you get a guy like me in there from the day that thing opened, I knew exactly how that thing is supposed to work, so I could go really, really fast. But it's a trick ride. It's too hard to get it to do what you'd like to do in the time frame that it runs, because it's an extremely heavy vehicle.
Yeah, because I look at the old video from back in the day when you had built the flying saucers, and those things skated across that area, and today they barely leave the space that they start in. So yeah, it's very interesting.
Well, it's because the vehicle is a gigantic heavy machine by itself, whether anybody's in it, and then when you add people to it, the dynamic mass is even greater. For the old vehicle, you couldn't put anybody much more than about 250 pounds in it, because it wouldn't lift up enough to do anything. But an average weight person, and of course a little tiny kid, the thing just jumped up and went like mad.
Yeah.
That whole system was designed by Carl Bacon and Ed Morgan at Aero Development. They came up with a clever system, and all I did was design the shape of this vehicle, and the vehicle is nothing but a big hubcap with no moving parts floating on the air.
That's funny to think of it as a giant hubcap, but that's very cool.
Well, that's the way it behaves.
Yeah. Now, you also designed the Great Omni Mover, which I think is a fantastic, because it doesn't stop, just people get on and get off. I had heard that an attraction like that, they have different speeds. They can slow it up or speed it, slow it down or speed it up, depending on, park capacity and things like that. Is there any truth to that, Bob?
Well, of course, haven't you ever ridden the Haunted Mansion Omni Mover?
Every time.
Yeah.
Don't you notice that when somebody comes in with a wheelchair or somebody that's walks very slowly with a cane. They simply slow it down to give person a much longer time on the loading speed ramp to climb into the car safely, and then it speeds back up again.
So how many speeds does it have? How fast how fast can we go on the Omnimover?
That's really simple. It goes from zero to full speed. And full speed is somewhere around just about 2.5 to 3 feet a second.
Okay.
Wow.
It's infinitely variable. Whatever the ride operators want to do, you just turn this knob and it speeds up or slows down. Simple as that.
Wow.
Really neat. And the same is true for the garden grill, right? The restaurant inside the land. I'm pretty sure there's speeds to how fast the whole restaurant spins around.
Well, I'm not completely familiar with that, but any attraction that most attractions have a variable speed. There's no point in having something where you can't vary the speed. And of course, electrical systems are such that variable speed is an inherent characteristic.
Yeah. Really cool. So
it's just like your car. You have a variable speed with your little tippy toe on the long pedal. Go up and down on it, and the speed will change.
Tony's got a variable speed in his car, don't you, Tony?
No, my car is one speed fast.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. If you have a Corvette, it's only as wide open or stopped.
Yep, that's it. Sometimes I may slow down for people, but that's on rare occasions.
Now, Bob, we understand that you have an interest in aviation as well. Are there Bob Gurr airplanes out there somewhere?
Never did design an airplane, but I've been passionate with airplanes from the time I looked up in the sky as a little teen kid and I saw an airplane. In fact, my father was very disappointed. As my first words were being formed, I would point at the sky and say, "Airplane." And I didn't say "Dada."
Yeah.
So my parents took note of that.
Yeah.
And of course, I was a licensed pilot for 50 years.
Wow.
I heard that you were also into gliders and had you were president of a glider association or a club?
Well, yes. I had a passion to fly gliders, when I was a little kid because over at where it is now a WBI Creative Campus, the Grand Central Air Terminal building next to it was a glider parked there when I was about 8 years old. And I just fell in love with it. And then there was a glider show and they did aerobatics over the airport. So I had gliders on my mind, but it was all the way till I was in my mid 20s before I was able to afford to join a glider club and start learning how to fly. And of course, because I just love gliders and sailplanes. That was a giant passion. And then the last 25 years of flying, I had a thing called a motor glider, which was like saying having a sailboat with a big Chevy engine and something like that, where you can take off with it and then turn the motor off, the propeller, and go flying the rest of the day over the mountains under the cumulus clouds. Just a great big glider, but it actually has a motor on it.
Wow. Yeah. I did not know they made gliders also with motors.
Oh, yes. There's three different categories. Larger ones with a larger engine, which is called a touring glider. You fly them just like a regular airplane. Sometimes they're one place. Sometimes they're two place. And then there's a type of glider that has an engine that you can take off. It's a retractable engine that folds up into the fuselage automatically. And if, something around maybe 25 horsepower, something like that. And then you have another one called a sustainer motor type, which you get towed in the air with a tow plane. But while you're flying along, and if you start to lose some of your updrafts, you put that motor out, and it's a smaller motor, and it'll keep you in the air because it doesn't have enough power to take off. But the touring type, which is what I had, it's just like a regular airplane when the motor's on.
Very cool. Yeah, out in I used to live out in Pennsylvania, and there was a town where they used to tow like a plane would tow a glider, look like up in the air, then pop the cable, and then the glider would just kind of, you know, fly around until it was, you know, the pilot was done.
Well, yeah, that was a very famous famous airport there. There were some very famous people back in the early 40s and 50s that developed that operation. A lot of schools around the United States have glider operations where you'll usually have a tow pilot and a rope, about 200-foot rope, and then the glider will be towed by the tow plane. And when they get to, say, 2,000 feet above the ground where there's some updrafts, the tow pilot, the glider pilot will release his end of the rope, and then the tow pilot will fly back to the airport with that rope, and then they'll hook up another glider. And, you know, just one right after another, put them all up in the air with a tow plane and a rope.
Yeah, yeah. We know that Bob Gurr loves cars, has a passion for cars. Did you ever actually design a vehicle or work for a car manufacturer? And is there a Bob Gurr car out there somewhere we don't know about?
Well, Disneyland, the Carnation shop with the little old antique truck, that was called the Gurrmobile.
Very cool.
So quite literally, there's...
Yeah. It had an emblem on the radiator shell that said Gurrmobile, Los Angeles.
I love it. Will you tell the story about the fire truck at Disneyland, too?
Well, yeah, Walt came into my office one day, and I said, "Say, Walt, you know, we don't have a fire engine." He says, "Yeah, but I mean, we don't." And then a few minutes later, I got a call from the accounting department, and then the lady gave me the project count number for the fire engine project, which, you know, if Walt wants something in his park, even though it's my ID, he's still got to go to the accounting department and get a number for it. So, it was a quick little job because that fire engine was based technically on the previous red car and the yellow car on Main Street. And it's because I wanted a fire engine. And it turns out that Walt always determined everything that goes in his park, and everybody knows that I'm the only one that suggests something that he took it up. But it turned out, I think he wanted a fire engine too, because the minute that fire engine got down there, whenever Walt wanted to show some people around or some publicity, he drove that fire engine.
Yeah, and I love that. And it kind of kept people at bay from asking for autographs and stuff like that, because you were in the fire engine.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, he found that out later on when I designed the little electric runabouts, that if you're in a vehicle and people are close to you, they won't interfere and ask you to do an autograph if you're in a vehicle. that gave him that little safety space, and he found out immediately with the fire engine. And, you know, it's an easy, you know, it's a little three-speed, you know, manual shift and clutch and everything. Walt knew how to drive that.
Yeah, that's great. I also read that you are a photography buff. Can you tell us maybe... Go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, can you tell us maybe, you know, the kind of camera equipment that you use, and maybe give us some Bob Gurr photo tips?
Well, I got interested in photography and when I was in high school, and always had some kind of a camera, always taking pictures of something. I got very serious about 1955, and I wound up, I had a Leica 3F red dial, and I developed my own film. I developed my own prints, you know, doing 8x10 black and white prints. Even in the 80s, I was doing color photography, making my own prints. And then, of course, digital photography came along. It wasn't very good for quite a while. And then some years ago, I started getting interested back into the digital now that it works extremely well. And so I have a Canon 7D, and I have about 7 or 8 lenses, different lengths for every kind of situation. So I still do photography today. I probably take about 10,000 shots a year. And I like to go out and give myself a photo assignment. Go learn this, go learn that. You know, like sometimes I'll go to the Los Angeles Zoo in the springtime at a certain kind of a day where the sky has got a certain kind of a haziness to it so I can get the color just the way I want. And I'll go study animals and see how I can learn there. Last year I went on an African safari in Botswana. It was a great chance to go learn about animals in the wild and study them, see how you can do that. I love taking pictures of people in certain situations. Like last year was the Chinese New Year parade. Boy, you have all these people that are looking so good, and you have all the color, you have all of the costumes and everything. Great big challenge. I went to the Oshkosh Air Show in Oshkosh this last summer, and the assignment there was take pictures of airplanes in the air and airplanes on the ground. I love to do all this. I do a lot of sunsets. I got hundreds of sunrises and sunsets from where I live here in California. So photography is an endless interest. It's if you do it, you're interested, you're always learning. There's so much stuff to learn. You'll never get it all figured out. It's a constant learning thing of knowing and understanding light. And you go back to the question you had, what can I suggest? How many times will you see somebody take a smart camera, I mean, a smartphone, which is really now cameras, which are very good, and they'll just simply go to click a picture, and they won't even stop to think, what is in the background? What is the light like? And you have these rotten photographs. Every time I see somebody approach me and say, oh, Bob, can we get a picture? I say, whoa, just a minute, hang on. Look at the background that you're going to put people against. That background is going to influence that little smartphone, because the smartphone can't figure out how to do it really, really well. They'll just do it kind of average-like. Second thing is, what is the light like in the area where you have people? And guess what they do? You'll have a full-length picture. They all look like telephone poles, and they're all squinting into the sun. Okay, yes. The first rule is never, never, never shoot pictures of people looking into the with the sun right on their face. There's always shade nearby. Guess what? You step them just out of the sun, just a little whisker out of the sun, where the light is on the ground. And guess what? The light will bounce on the ground up to their face. Now you'll have a soft light, and it looks really, really pretty. Next thing is, move the people around, move the camera around so that the background is very, very dark, especially a dark shadow area. Never the sky, never something really bright. Because how many times somebody will say, take my picture and with this beautiful distant scene behind me. Well, guess what? You have this black silhouette face with this great big sky behind you. Don't ever do that. Got to realize the camera is going to see an average exposure. You want that face to be the best possible part of that exposure. The best way to do that, again, is don't use bright sunlight. Use reflected light from the ground up to their face and position them against a very, very dark background. You can look around an area, you can find that. Now, what that means is now you have a contrast where the face is a much brighter part of that picture than the background. And the other thing, stand really close. You don't need to have everybody's feet showing. Walk right up so that the bottom of the picture, you should cut them off just above their belt line. And now you'll have good-looking people.
Those are fantastic tips.
They really are.
And I do remember when we took a picture in Celebration that you said, over here in this light, and you had the background all set up. So, those are great tips, Bob.
Okay.
Really
good. Just go out, grab your smartphone, and go out in the park and do it.
Yeah.
No, really, you'll be surprised if you just think of just those simple principles. You can take pictures of people in a Disney park, and just use those principles, and you'll come back with super pictures.
Fantastic! That's great. Well, speaking of parks, now at Disneyland, you're one of the rare individuals who have a window on Main Street, and there's a bike kind of shape to it, right? Or a bike nearby. What's the story on that?
Well, the people that design those windows like to theme them correctly. And if you actually look at the window, you'll see that it says something like the Meteor Sickle Company. Remember, this is 1900 on Main Street. I have a bicycle shop, and the Meteor Sickle company, it says leading the race to the future, which means, oh, you know, monorails are fast. It's future. You know, it says fast. Okay, that's monorail. It says faultless. My stuff was bulletproof and ran all the time. It says fabulous. Well, that means classic. And then, of course, they say Bob Gerd designed Impresario. But there's a guy and a gal on this old these old bicycles saying our vehicle's past the test of time. Well, it turns out I'm a mountain biker. Well, obviously, Bob ran a bicycle shop about 110 years ago in Disneyland. And then, of course, there's a guy in the shop who says, oh, I want to build a bike and we'll make a dimensional sign and stick it on the side of the building. He did that on his own, off the books, so that did not cost the company anything. The guy volunteered to build it himself. Aww. And he built it and put it on the wall. Of course, everybody's upset because, well, how come everybody else doesn't get a dimensional sign? Well, when Roly Crump got one, they made sure they had a dimensional sign hanging in front of his window. So my bicycle started a big ruckus.
Now everybody wants something three-dimensional, huh?
Right.
But you were the first. So that's important.
Right.
Now, I understand, too, that you're coming to Orlando in March for a really fun event. So can we talk about that a little bit?
Sure. Do you know about it?
I do. I may know a little bit about it, yes.
Well, tell me about it, then I'll know what it is I'm going to do.
Well, we're very excited to have you come down, and you're going to be doing a private tour for about 15 people, and we're going to have lunch with Bob Gerd, and then we are going to tour the parks and just be with the man who's responsible for so much and inspired so much inside Disney World, and just kind of point things out to us and talk to us in your Bob Gerd style. So we're just really excited about you coming to do that with us.
That's going to be easy to do.
Yeah, it'll be fun.
At the end of the day, do we go to a saloon and you're going to buy me a Gertini?
Absolutely. Are you kidding? You don't even have to ask. We'll go up to Top of the World and sign your monorail maybe one more time.
All right.
While you're here.
Bob, did you hear that story that the panel of glass that you signed broke?
Oh yeah, there's something that says that when I signed the first one, the somebody erased it. Then I signed it the second time, so they broke the glass.
I think there's very bad mojo up there, Bob.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Well, I want to thank you very much for your time. It's always very interesting to hear you speak about all these great things that you've done. For Disney, and there's a lot of great things that you've done, not for Disney, for Universal and movies and the Olympics, and you have a legacy of fantastic work. So I really want to thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Yeah, all the Disney work was really good, but as soon as I escaped from Disney, all the really exciting jobs came my way, and those were the big thrilling ones. Oddly enough, was the stuff starting with the arch enemy, Universal Studios, and of course Las Vegas, Michael Jackson, Olympics, all that stuff, plus a whole bunch of other stuff. It was all of the really super wild fun jobs. I just loved every one of them.
Yeah.
No, you had a hand in creating the King Kong that we had here in Orlando, I believe, on the King Kong attraction for Universal.
Oh, they took that out years ago.
Yes. Well, I'm reading that they're making another one or something similar. So if that's true, then we'll definitely have to go check it out whenever it's built.
Yeah, they wanted to put the mummy ride in that. That's a great big set building. That's Universal's biggest soundstage set building. Mm-hmm. And they always like to put a new attraction based on their movies. So the King Kong was there. I think it ran about 11 years. There ran 22 years here in L.A., but yeah, there were two King Kongs in that one. One of the Kongs was which we I forget the name. We had two different terminology. One of them was 42 feet tall, trying to grab people, and the other one that had arms 54 feet across. So it would reach up and wow. try to grab the tram with the people in it. Mm-hmm. It was those two were really spectacular machines from a mechanical standpoint. They were probably the biggest, most far out thing I ever attempted.
Wow. And now there's an Ursula in, where is it, Tokyo or Hong Kong?
Yeah. In fact, that was the last big piece of show action equipment I designed was that apparatus that thrust that Ursula out over the audience. It's got a long, complicated story how that came about. It moved around through the Disney company and other companies, but I wound up doing all the initial concept for it, and then wound up getting... built and installed, and everybody happy with it.
Fantastic. Amazing. Well, don't hang up, but we'll probably need to go ahead and wrap up the show. We just want to thank you again for coming on, and you are a true Renaissance man, a true legend. We're just so honored to have you on the Disney Parks podcast. Thank you for your time.
Well, it's my pleasure. I look forward to my visit down there on March 4th, the 9th, and we'll see how much fun we're going to have.
Absolutely. Thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you in the parks.
The Disney Parks Podcast is not affiliated with the Walt Disney Company. All Disney parks, attractions, lands, shows, event names, etc. are registered trademarks of the Walt Disney Company.
Like a out of the blue, fate steps in and sees you through. One reach upon a star, your dream.